Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. It's the Friday News Roundup, where we discuss the stories making headlines across the region. Cape Cod is bracing for a nurses' strike that is set to start on Wednesday. The strike involves home care nurses who work for the Visiting Nurse Association of Cape Cod, and protests are planned around the region tomorrow as part of a day of action by the No Kings movement. CAI's Jeanette Barnes is here with those stories. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi, Mindy.
All right, so you've been on the protest beat this week, it seems. Start by telling us what's happening with this nurses' strike coming up on Wednesday. You know, who does it affect and why are they striking?
Well, the workers who are going to be striking are registered nurses. They do home care and hospice for the Visiting Nurse Association of Cape Cod, which is part of Cape Cod Healthcare. They've been negotiating a new contract, but the visiting nurses say that what they are being offered just is not sufficient. They want the same percentage raise that hospital nurses at Cape Cod Healthcare got in their new contract, which was announced in August. And the hospital nurses got a 19% raise over a 3-year period. The visiting nurses say they're not actually expecting to make as high a wage as hospital nurses do. They have not historically. Their pay was already about 20% lower than the hospital nurses. But what they are looking for is a comparable percentage raise. Just a little side note here, since we did cover a picket at St. Luke's Hospital in New Bedford, the registered nurses there just announced their new contract yesterday. But St. Luke's has different ownership than the Cape Hospital, so they're not really closely related.
All right. So what does Cape Cod Healthcare have to say about this?
Well, Cape Cod Healthcare would not give me an interview, and other than one factual clarification about their written statement, they wouldn't answer any questions. They just sent, again, that statement in writing. Cape Cod Healthcare says that its pay offer for the visiting nurses is significantly higher than its competitors, and that benefits are higher than industry standards, but they didn't provide any numbers to illustrate that argument. They also said that financial conditions for home health care and for hospice are challenging because reimbursement rates for those kinds of services have been reduced.
So what's going to happen to patient care during this 3-day strike?
Well, Cape Cod Healthcare said back in September that they have contingency plans to make sure people receive the care they need during the strike. In September is when the Visiting Nurses Union voted to authorize a strike if the impasse were to continue. So, you know, both sides did know well in advance that this could happen, and we know it's time limited. It is 3 days. So apparently Cape Cod Healthcare feels they're going to be able to get the nursing coverage they need.
You mentioned that visiting nurses don't get paid as much as hospital nurses, and that's not what they're asking for, right? But visiting nurses do have to work under some unpredictable conditions sometimes.
Yes, that is true. For this story, I talked with a nurse case manager who's a visiting nurse. And she said, first of all, they know that hospital care is different and challenging in other ways. But when the visiting nurses are going into people's homes, they find all different kinds of conditions there, some sanitary and some not, right? And they're doing things like changing dressings and all of that. They also have no security staff immediately at hand the way they do in the hospital if there's a problem. They don't have colleagues to, you know, bounce ideas off that are directly there on the spot. So it is a different kind of environment.
I know the two sides in this contract dispute have gone back and forth about staffing issues, too. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So the union representing the visiting nurses is the Massachusetts Nurses Association, and the union issued a press release about this contract dispute. In it, they make some allegations about the turnover of staff. They say that the VNA experiences chronic turnover of staff, and that almost a third of the nurses are travel nurses who are expensive to pay, and they don't provide the same consistency of staff nurses. But Cape Cod Healthcare really pushed back on those allegations. They say that the union statements are misleading. They say the registered nurse turnover among Cape Cod visiting nurses is under 7%, which
they compared to a regional average across New England of 27%. And then on the traveling nurses, Cape Cod Healthcare says that hiring a certain number of traveling nurses is necessary to cover open positions and leaves of absence and such.
So the strike starts Wednesday. Do we know what their plans are for picketing?
Well, they are planning to picket for those 3 days, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. They say they'll be out from about 8 to 4, but they haven't announced the locations.
All right, let's move on to No Kings protests. No Kings is the name of a largely decentralized movement that opposes President Trump and his administration. The idea got a lot of attention in June when protests were timed to coincide with the Trump administration's military parade. So what's happening this time around?
Well, this time, to my knowledge, the protests are not really tied to a specific event like that, but progressive organizations are following up to kind of keep the heat on President Trump and call out some of the things they object to that have happened since June. So protests are scheduled for Saturday, tomorrow, at more than 2,000 locations across the country and a dozen communities right in CAI's immediate listening area. They will be, as we've been reporting, they'll be on Martha's Vineyard in Nantucket. They'll be in several towns across the Cape and several towns on the South Coast. Mattapoisett is actually the location of a march tomorrow on the same issue, but most of these are stationary demonstrations. As you said, the organizing of these protests is somewhat decentralized, so various organizations are running them. I talked with Wendy Lawton of Indivisible South Coast New England. She said her group is running two of the protests. Some Democratic town committees are also involved in organizing them.
So they're protesting the Trump administration, but what are some of the specific messages that they're trying to get across?
Well, in some ways, it depends on the interests of the individuals and the groups involved, right? Like some are going to have specific issues that are more important to them. People will probably have signs that have themes around immigration, around healthcare funding, and civil rights. But really, the overarching issue they all have in common is what they see as President Trump engaging in authoritarian grabs at power, as they put it. So that is the theme. They also say they are committed to nonviolence in these protests.
All right. So you also tried to get some local conservative groups to comment on those ideas. What happened with that?
Yeah, well, the short answer is none of them responded to a request for comment. I reached out to three groups to try to get some conservative remarks on the ideas behind the No Kings protest. They were the Cape Cod Republican Club, another conservative group on the Cape that has done some pro-Trump demonstrations that's called United Cape Patriots, and then the state GOP. As I said, none of them got back to me. Cape Cod Republicans, actually, the Cape Cod Republican Club, their email bounced back twice, so they weren't seeing that. But I then tried to message them on social media and didn't hear back.
All right. CAI's Jeanette Barnes. Thank you, Jeanette.
All right. Thanks.
CAI science reporter Amy Kolb-Noyes is here to talk about dolphin communication. This is such a cool story. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Mindy.
So this week you reported on a scientist at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution who won a big cash prize for her research. So tell us about that.
That's right. Dr. Layla Saig is a senior research specialist with WHOE's biology department, and she specializes in dolphin communication, as you said. She won the first annual Collar Doolittle Prize, which came with a $100,000 purse.
And Doolittle, like Dr. Doolittle?
Yeah, that's right. The prize is funded by the Jeremy Collar Foundation in partnership with Tel Aviv University. And Collar is a British billionaire who wants to support the development of two-way interspecies communication, hence the Doolittle name. And this annual prize is in support of teams who the foundation deems to be on that path.
This is really part of a broader challenge, though, right?
Yes. There's also a major award of either $500,000 cash or a $10 million equity investment in the team that, quote, cracks the code of interspecies communication.
Right. And what about the research that caught the judge's attention? What was the research that they saw?
So the language that the award used said, I'm quoting here, that Dr. Seig's team provided the first evidence of widespread sharing on stereotyped non-signature whistles in wild dolphins.
Ah, what does that mean?
Well, it helps to zoom out a little bit. Dr. Seig works with the Brookfield Zoo Chicago's Sarasota Dolphin Research Program, which studies a resident population of about 170 bottlenose dolphins down in Sarasota, Florida. And she's been working with them for almost 40 years. Most of that time, they've been documenting what they call signature whistles. And those, they believe, are sort of like human names. Dolphins vocalize their own signature whistles, and sometimes they imitate other dolphins' whistles. And researchers liken this to possibly calling a friend by name, or maybe even talking about someone when they're not around. So for most of her career, Dr. Seig documented these signature whistles. But in recent years, she started to notice that multiple dolphins use other whistles in certain situations. So these are what they're calling the non-signature whistles, which were referenced by the Collard Doolittle Prize.
So do researchers think these non-signature whistles have specific meanings then?
Yeah, that's the working theory. They've identified more than 20 of these whistles that could be a form of shared language. Right now, Dr. Seig is focused on two different whistles that she's heard vocalized by dozens of different dolphins. The first one she theorizes is kind of an alarm signal that alerts others to potential danger. Do you want to hear it?
Absolutely.
Okay, here's a recording of that whistle, but it's slowed down to quarter speed, which makes it easier for us to hear as humans. Get that?
Yeah. So how are they testing their theory?
So they play that recording underwater at regular speed, of course, when dolphins are in the area. And using camera drones and spotters, they observe the dolphin's reaction. So for that whistle, a common reaction is for the dolphins to turn around and go the other way. So that's why they think it's a warning whistle. Although Dr. Seig did say one young male actually came right over to the speaker when they played that whistle, which kind of checks.
What's the danger, right? Right, so what's the other non-signature whistle that she's experimenting with?
So the other one they think is an expression of surprise, like a dolphin saying, "What was that?" Which kind of makes sense if you think about the researchers playing possibly confusing sounds, like playing a dolphin's signature whistle back at it. So that query whistle sounds like this. Again, it's slowed down to quarter speed.
Wow, so fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah, very cool. That one to me sounds like tuning in an AM signal.
I know, right? Right, exactly. All right, CAI Science and Environment reporter Amy Kolb-Noyce, thank you so much.
Thanks, Mindy.
All right, the food pantry on Nantucket's closer to getting a new home. Jason Graziade from the Nantucket Current is here with that. Hi, Jason.
Good morning.
So this is a pretty big deal.
This is a big deal for the island, and this has been a topic of conversation, you know, for a good portion of this year, is where is the Nantucket Food Pantry going to end up? Its lease agreement with the town was coming to an end. The town is utilizing that current space for the expansion of the Nantucket Regional Transportation Authority, the Wave buses, and the food pantry had been searching for a new home, you know, for a long time, something that could serve its growing the growing need in the food insecurity issues that we have here on the island. This week, the Nantucket Land Bank announced that it was close to reaching agreement on what they're calling a collaborative purchase of a property in the Mid-Island area, and partnering with the Nourish Nantucket, which is a new nonprofit dedicated to solving food insecurity, and the food pantry, and creating a space that will not only serve as a new headquarters for the food pantry, but also as a butchery where, you know, they can do expanded deer processing and processed venison. So really sort of tackling two issues that we have here on the island, one being food insecurity and one the overpopulation of deer on the island. We have, you know, by one estimate, you know, upwards of 10,000 deer on Nantucket, and it's become a major, discussion point and talking point given some of the problems that they cause with that overpopulation. So it's going to be an interesting to see how, if this deal comes to fruition, how they pull that off in one space. It is a former catering kitchen, and it has parking. It's in the Mid-Island area, so it's a great location and would be a good base of operations for both of those organizations.
It sounds like, you know, they've been looking for this for a while, as you said, and this sounds like a, you know, it would be their dream list, right? I mean, to have all of this together under one roof.
Yeah, and that's what they said, is that, you know, this would really, you know, address two big issues on the island. And, you know, obviously the food pantry, people have been very concerned about where they were going to end up and how they were going to, you know, come to a landing spot after, you know, having to move out of their current location. So they're hopeful that this is under agreement, and hopefully it comes to be closed later this year.
Yeah, good. That's good news. All right. So, and then you just never know what you might find on the beach after a storm.
You never know. And on Nantucket, it could be any number of things that wash up. After the nor'easter, we spoke with a woman who lives on the island, Karen Russell, who discovered out on the east end of the island in the low beach area near Sconset what appears to be the remains of a shipwreck. You know, this was a fragment, maybe a 400 or 500 pound fragment that could be the stern post and part of a rudder. The pintails were still attached. She believes it's potentially a 19th century vessel. The Egan Maritime Institute, working with the state archaeologist, is now investigating. They've gone out to the site, photographed it, and are doing a little bit more research. But a very cool find for Karen and the rest of the island to see this. And it's happened a couple times in recent years, but something that's always very cool to see.
Yeah, and to find something that's, you know, that old. And, of course, you've got the expertise there on the island to find out, you know, what this really is.
Exactly. And, you know, Egan Maritime was involved back in 2023 when a huge portion of a shipwreck appeared on the south shore, was unearthed, and that ended up being the story of that was the wreck of the Warren Sawyer, which wrecked on the near Mayakama Beach in 1884. So that was a cool one, and we're hoping to get some answers on this one as well.
Be exciting when we find out, you know, where it came from. Jason Graziadei from the Nantucket Current. Thanks, Jason.
Thanks for having me on.
Coming up, legal issues could complicate housing in Chatham and possible changes to driving on Chappaquiddick's sandy trails. Stay with us. You're listening to the News Roundup on The Point. Coast Guard rescued a man in the water off Woods Hole who'd been aboard a Steamship Authority ferry, and Ethan Gettner from the Vineyard Gazette has more on that. Hi, Ethan.
Good morning, Mindy.
So what do we know at this point? You know, for a while there, we weren't sure if this was a passenger on the ferry or, you know, what happened. Tell us a little bit more.
Yeah, so what we do know is this kind of all started on Monday afternoon when the island home was headed from the Vineyard over to Woods Hole. And around a little before 3:30, they noticed what they believed to be a person in the water. We've come to learn that was a passenger on another ferry on the Vineyard route. They were later scooped up by the Coast Guard around 4:30, so they had been in the water for at least an hour. No one really knows yet, or they haven't told us at least, how long that person maybe had been in the water before that. But yeah, it was kind of a very kind of crazy, dramatic day.
Yeah, and really very lucky considering the weather conditions, right?
Yeah, I mean, so for people who don't remember what it was like on Monday, we had a nor'easter coming through. You know, winds were predicted, you know, sustained 25 to 30 miles an hour. We had gusts up to 55, and the water was kicking out there. And it's not exactly warm this time of year either.
Yeah. All right. So we hope that we know he went to Joint Base Cape Cod and then to the hospital and was treated, I guess, for hypothermia. Hope he's okay.
Yeah, treated for exposure. Injuries not expected to be life-threatening, which is kind of miraculous, given the situation.
Yeah. All right, and then you've got a story on new rules are being considered for driving on Chappaquiddick's sandy trails. What's happening there?
Yeah, so for people who don't know, on Chappaquiddick, the Trustees of Reservations has about 16 miles of trails that you can take your 4x4 out on. It's really hugely popular with fishermen and just kind of beachgoers. But it's been very hotly contested for several years now about, you know, how many cars is too many out there. In Edgartown, the town had ruled on a number that was then appealed by the trustees, as well as neighbors who said it was too many cars. Trustees said there was too few. So this is kind of all coming to a head as the Conservation Commission is supposed to kind of consider new limits for it. There's kind of lawsuits flying all over the place as this all kind of goes on.
Yeah. So the proposal maybe would what, limit the number of cars? Is that the idea? They're not going to shut it down altogether, are they?
No, correct. So right now there's two different areas of Chappaquiddick. So right now the town has imposed you can have 200 cars in like Leland and Waysquee parts, which is kind of the lower end of Chappie, and then 30 going up to Cape Pogue. This new proposal, which is coming from the trustees, is 275 vehicles across the whole island. So no kind of bifurcated different situations. And so fishermen are pleased with this. They like this idea of kind of more access. They say, you know, the island doesn't have a lot of access to its beaches out here, and these beaches are essentially private. If you can't get to them, the neighbors, I think, are a little nervous, and the people who own property out there, and there's concerns about, you know, have the trustees really managed this kind of precious resource very well.
Yeah. So when do we expect a decision?
So the Edgartown Conservation Commission is supposed to talk this week coming, and, you know, they could make a decision, but the way this has gone, there's a trial also set for, I believe it's on Monday, on another issue out there regarding OSVs. And, you know, just about every decision has come with an appeal immediately after. So I don't know that this is going to be exactly settled, but we'll see, where it ends up.
All right, you'll be on it and we'll be listening. Ethan Gettner from the Vineyard Gazette. Thank you, Ethan.
Thanks, Mindy.
Legal issues could complicate some housing in Chatham. Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle has more on that. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Mindy.
So at the heart of this battle is what, the intent of the original donor of the land?
Yeah, this land is at 127 Old Harbor Road, close to downtown Chatham. In 1971, the original owner who had passed away had in her will donating this property to the town of Chatham for use as a playground and for recreation. The town meeting accepted it in 1971 for that use. And a playground was, in fact, built on the rear of that property. But there's a house on that property and a barn, and those have been sporadically used over the years. And now, in the last few years, the town has been looking at that property to construct affordable or attainable housing.
Yeah. But it seems like lawyers on both sides seem to have some good points. It's going to be interesting to see how this plays out, right?
Yeah, so two attorneys representing neighbors have told the town that the town could face legal exposure if they don't honor the intent of the will from Marion Ellis, who donated the property. There's a counter decision or opinion on the part of town council. A previous town council had ruled that the restriction expired after 30 years, and the current town council doesn't agree with that, but says that the town, in using part of the property for the playground, is honoring the will, and the rest of the property could be used for housing, which town meeting voted to do a couple of years ago. The select board at this point have sort of put a pause on this project. They had some proposals or some test fits, they call them, of what sort of housing could go on the property. And they're waiting for another, opinion from town council, which they're scheduled to receive on November 18th before they vote to go ahead with this housing project on the property.
Yeah, more to come on this one. All right, over in Harwich, there's a proposal to protect some land that has some significant natural resources.
Yeah, the Harwich Conservation Trust and the Harwich Town Real Estate and Open Space Committee have developed a proposal to transfer 15 town-owned parcels of land from under the jurisdiction of the Select Board to the Conservation Commission and the town's Water Department. What they're saying is that all these parcels have significant natural resources on them, and they would be better suited that are stewarded under the Conservation of the Water Department, which would basically protect these parcels as open space in perpetuity, with the Harwich Conservation Trust holding a conservation restriction on the parcels. There seems to be pretty much agreement on this. It would require a town meeting vote to transfer this jurisdiction. And everybody seems to think that it's a good idea to protect these properties for natural resources, for wildlife, and for coastal resilience.
And probably because they're not developable, right? These lots are not, so it seems like a no-brainer, right?
Yeah, apparently there may be one of the parcels that town officials have said could possibly be developed into maybe a one affordable house or something, but they're not even sure about that. They're doing some research on that to try to figure out if that's the case. But most of the parcels are, you know, like you said, Mindy, within, they're wetlands, or they're within a certain area to a conservation area. So they would basically be better off protected under these conservation and water departments.
And then on Stage Harbor Road in Chatham, you have a demolition delay.
Yeah, so the town's historical commission has put a 1-year delay on a proposal to demolish a 120-year-old house on Stage Harbor Road. The owners of the house say that the structure is not in very good condition, and it doesn't suit their needs as modern living. They want to demolish the house and build a new one, but the commission is saying that the streetscape along Stage Harbor Road would suffer if that were the case. And they would like the owners to figure out a way to save what is basically the core of the historic house, which was originally a small cottage. And they'd like them to preserve that and try to find a way to build maybe perhaps a new addition on the rear of that property so that the original streetscape would maintain the way it is. This project is slated to go before the zoning board next month. And, we'll see if they do that. They had proposed it a year or more ago and ended up withdrawing it from the zoning board because the zoning board wasn't going to approve it. So we'll see if their plans this time meet with better luck.
And this is one of the most historic streets in town, right?
It certainly is. It was one of the original pathways that led to the water. There are dozens of historic homes on the property. The Historic Commission actually tried to get this designated as a National Historic District a few years ago, but they ran into opposition from the property owners who felt that it would impinge upon their rights, mm-hmm. their property rights. So mm-hmm. that was never done, but that doesn't really diminish the historic significance of this of this street.
All right, Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Thanks, Tim.
Thank you, Mindy.
A longtime member of the Nauset Regional School Committee says the district has not been following its own policies on homeschool oversight. That's according to Tyler Jaeger of the Provincetown Independent. CIA's Gilda Guy spoke with Tyler to learn more about how the former school committee's chair's claims may tie into a lawsuit against a religious group in Orleans.
Who is Chris Easley, and what did he tell you about his experience with homeschooling oversight in the Nauset Regional School District?
Yeah, so Chris Easley is the former longtime chair of the Regional School Committee in the Nauset District, which covers enrollment from Brewster to Wellfleet and also takes high school students from Truro and from Provincetown. He's one of the longest serving members on the school committee, having first been elected in 2014. And what Easley's told us is over that whole tenure, he believed there was minimal and limited oversight of homeschooling in the school district. And in particular, the school is responsible for ensuring every child is getting an education in the district. And one part of that is the superintendent is supposed to send a report annually to the school committee on how homeschooled students are faring. And Easley says the committee never received it in that time. I should add that we checked all available meeting minutes for the period we're looking at, and as far as we can tell, they appear to corroborate his claim.
What laws or policies exist here in Massachusetts that are supposed to make sure students who are homeschooled are actually getting an education? And from your reporting, does it seem like Nauset Regional School District followed those laws?
It does, actually. And as far as we can tell, the school is following the minimum state requirements on homeschooling oversight. But it's also worth noting that we've heard from other school districts as well that those rules are quite limited. Now, Massachusetts is an approval state, meaning that a district or a superintendent needs to approve a parent or guardian's homeschooling plan. And then after that, it's really up to school districts to decide what additional oversight they want to conduct at their own discretion. But the guidance on what approval or monitoring is supposed to take place is really quite vague.
How does all of this tie into the ongoing lawsuit against the Community of Jesus, the religious group in Orleans?
It's relevant because while we don't know the number of students who were actually homeschooled in the school district in this period, the district couldn't get that information to us, we do know that at least one student, Oliver Ortolani, alleges in federal court that he was deprived of nearly 2 years of schooling in the Nauset district during this time. Now, Ortolani says he grew up in the Community of Jesus and lived there during this period that he alleges he expected to be homeschooled in 2019 and 2020. And instead, he says, members of this group brought him to work at a construction site at the age of 12 for up to 16 hours a day.
So you reached out to a lot of different people from the school district and beyond for this story. So how did folks respond to Easley's claims?
You know, when it came to the school district itself, its current administration, we didn't get very far in getting a lot of substantial response to Easley's claims. And one point to note there is there has been a great degree of turnover in the school district since the period that we're really looking at here, 2019 and 2020. We've had two school superintendents since that period, and very few of the current school committee was actually serving in the period that Easley was serving. This was also during the pandemic, right, at least for the sort of second half of the period that Ortolani alleges he didn't get an education. We had more luck speaking to current administrators at other school districts, namely Monomoy and Dennis Yarmuth, about their current homeschool plans. And some policies do diverge from Nauset's. Monomoy, for instance, we heard from the director of curriculum instruction there, Robin Millen, checks in on their homeschooled students at least 2 times a year. And the superintendent of Dennis Yarmuth recounted having done follow-ups with students he was concerned about in homeschooling plans, including in at least one case where he filed a report to the state on behalf of a student who he worried wasn't receiving an education.
That's Tyler Jaeger of the Provincetown Independent. Tyler, thanks so much.
Thanks a ton, Gilda.
Coming up, we'll hear the latest from Beacon Hill.
I'm very attached to the pierogi. And I, even when I was a kid at home learning to cook, I was attached to them. I was always interested. I always had the passion for the pierogi. You have to have the love of the pierogi because it's very time-consuming and it's a lot of work. And if you don't love it, then stay away from it.
Patty Geary of Fall River on making traditional Polish dumplings, or pierogi.
They all have their own personality. They don't always come out perfect. Some of them open up in the water. They can give you a hard time. The dough can give you a hard time. The weather has a lot to do with the dough. So that's what I'm saying. You have to have the love and the patience, or else it's not for you. So I'm very proud of them, and I'm, you know, working hard to keep that going.
You're listening to the Cape and Islands NPR stations.
You're listening to the News Roundup on The Point. Are county sheriffs in Massachusetts spending too much money? And is there any way to bring down heating costs in the state this winter? That's what state leaders are wondering this week, according to State House reporter Katie Lannon. CAI's Gilda Geis spoke with Katie to learn more.
State lawmakers voted this week on a proposal to withhold millions of dollars for county sheriff's offices across the state. Why do they want to withhold the money, and how did they vote?
So this vote really came at a time where sheriffs at different corners of the state are under scrutiny. The sheriff here in Boston is facing federal extortion charges, and the sheriff in Norfolk County recently had to pay back some campaign money that state officials say he used improperly. So they're under a spotlight, but what state lawmakers are really looking at here is the amount of money the sheriff's offices are spending. Sheriffs are able to spend more money to run their programs than they're initially budgeted by Beacon Hill, and they essentially send the bill to the state house at the end of the year. And this year, state lawmakers say they asked for more than 3 times as much money as they did the previous year. So they want to do a review and get a handle on it. This bill passed overwhelmingly, and it didn't really generate any sort of vocal opposition within the legislature. So it seems like something that many at the state house are on board with.
How are sheriff's offices reacting?
Also, seem to be relatively on board overall. I think they do seem to, obviously they want to be able to pay their bills, but the sheriffs say that they welcome a review as a way that would strengthen public confidence in how they run their offices. They say they invest in evidence-based programs and spend responsibly. In Barnstable County, Sheriff Buckley is saying that she also shares the legislature's commitment to spending taxpayer dollars appropriately, and that, you know, this has been kind of the way that this whole routine of asking for more money at the end of the fiscal year has been how it's always been done. But she welcomes any sort of improvements lawmakers might find to the way that they do things.
Also this week, Governor Mara Healey asked state utility regulators to do a thorough review of consumer gas and electric bills. So what's her goal here?
Yeah, if you've ever opened a gas or electric bill when they come in the mail, you know it's not just one price tag. There's all sorts of extra charges for things like renewable energy and transmission lines. So the governor is asking the Department of Public Utilities to look over line by line what all those charges are. And if there are ones that aren't serving the consumer, aren't providing a benefit in some way, she wants to see those removed or lowered or changed in some way. Ultimately, she wants to prevent the kinds of major cost spikes that really hammered household budgets in last winter's heating season.
So what will this review look like? And can people expect maybe more affordable heating bills this winter?
Yeah, it's a little kind of up in the air what this will look like because it is something that has never been done before. So part of that, too, is we don't know how long it will take for there to be results, if there are any. The governor said that she wants this done as soon as possible, but didn't say directly if she expects that to mean savings this coming winter.
Katie Lannon from the State House, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Earlier this hour, we heard science reporter Amy Kolb-Noyes talk about dolphin research. That research is so interesting, we thought you might like to hear that report. As Amy reports, one Woods Hole scientist has gotten a boost from an unusual source.
Layla Saig is getting ready to go see some old friends. Saig is a senior research specialist in the biology department at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. She's headed down to Sarasota, Florida, where she's been studying dolphin communication with the same population of bottlenose dolphins for nearly 40 years.
So it's really like a natural laboratory. There's a resident population of about 170 animals, and all of them are known to the researchers, their ages, sexes, who their moms and grandmothers and et cetera, up to six generations, and who they hang out with. So it's really an amazing opportunity to study communication because there's so much known about their relationships.
Researchers at the Sarasota Dolphin Research Program have been studying this population year-round for decades, and that historical data is critical to SAIG's work. Her research suggests the way dolphins and humans communicate may have more in common than you might think. Saig has spent much of her career identifying and cataloging each dolphin's unique signature whistle. The whistles function somewhat like a human name in that they help dolphins identify each other. Did you hear that? It's one dolphin's signature whistle. Here it is at quarter speed, which is easier for humans to hear. Dolphins vocalize their own signature whistles and sometimes imitate others. Researchers say that may be like humans calling a friend by name or even talking about them when they're not around. Saig and her team have also concluded that, like human mothers, dolphins change their tone when whistling to their young.
We don't know if it functions in any way similarly, but humans tend to speak in kind of a higher-pitched, more sing-songy type voice with infants and children, and we found that bottlenose dolphins, females, when they're communicating with their calves, will increase the pitch of their signature whistles.
In May, Saig was awarded the first annual Collar Doolittle Prize, sponsored by the Jeremy Collar Foundation. The $100,000 purse is meant to fund research that supports progress towards interspecies communication, and Saig is using part of her prize money to fund her fieldwork in Sarasota this fall. But the prize was not awarded for her HUI team's extensive catalog of signature whistles. It was given for the identification of outliers, non-signature whistles, used by dozens of dolphins throughout the population. Saig and her team use non-invasive acoustic tags and underwater microphones called hydrophones, which they suction cup to the dolphins. From those recordings, they create spectrograms so they can analyze the whistles visually.
When I first noticed it, I honestly kind of thought I was like going bonkers because we'd always just sort of ignored these whistles. And I was like, this is definitely happening. And some of them are quite unusual, too.
The work on non-signature whistles is in its early stages and has not yet been peer-reviewed. But the team reports finding more than 20 non-signature whistles. Saig says, so far, she's concentrating on just a couple.
I'm just focusing right now on two different non-signature whistle types to see if I can get a large enough sample size of those across a lot of different age, sex, context, generations. And then, of course, we would want to expand that to other non-signature whistle types, too.
The first whistle Saig is studying, she says, is quite distinctive.
That was so unusual that I literally, at first, wasn't even sure that it was a dolphin. But now I've seen probably 30 different animals making that whistle.
At quarter speed, it sounds like this.
Our preliminary analyses that I've done of that whistle are suggestive that it could be some type of alarm signal. So some kind of like a alerting animals to danger or concern of some kind.
The other non-signature whistle she'll be experimenting with in Sarasota sounds like this one slowed down. That, she theorizes, is kind of like a dolphin saying, huh?
We think now what they were doing was sort of expressing surprise. That's our best guess about how this whistle functions now anyway, is that it's sort of a what was that kind of thing.
As Saig heads to Sarasota to run more experiments on non-signature whistles, she's also directed some of her prize money to colleagues in Denmark who are helping to build a catalog of those whistle types. The goal is to utilize artificial intelligence to help classify non-signature whistles. Saig says Jeremy Collar, the British financier behind the Collar Doolittle Prize, is interested in harnessing AI. And in addition to the annual $100,000 prize, there's a major award of either $500,000 cash or a $10 million equity investment for the team that, quote, cracks the code of interspecies communication.
I could walk with the animals, talk with the animals, grunt and squeak and squawk with the animals. And they could squeak and squawk and speak and talk to me.
For CAI, I'm Amy Cold Noise.
And we end the hour with an inspiring story. Rowers from around the world are trickling into Boston for this weekend's Head of the Charles Regatta. And for one couple, it's an event that transcends countries and age. Esteban Bustillos went to the Cambridge Boathouse just as they were setting out on the water.
He was a former naval pilot who rowed at Harvard but had taken a decades-long break from the sport. She was a former world champion with the Soviet Union, who happened to be about 20 years younger. But sports have a way of leveling out the playing field, and Carlos Zeza remembers meeting Margarita at a race in 2007 and trying to figure out if they could be partners, rowing partners. Zeza wanted to see if Margarita was eligible to be in his age category.
So when I first met her, there was a guy standing there. After learning her name, I said, "How old are you?" And the guy beside her said, "You're talking to my rowing partner."
But Zeza ended up getting the last laugh. Margarita became his rowing partner and his wife. At 89 years of age, Carlos says it's a union that helps push him forward. And now he holds a unique place at the head of the Charles Regatta.
Well, there are rowers older than me. I don't know of any who are faster, who have been faster. You never know.
Rowing has been a part of the Zeza's lives for about as long as they can remember. Carlo began rowing when he was 14 years old, in 1950.
Yeah, it's a long time ago.
But like many athletes, other priorities popped up. After Harvard, Carlo was busy with the Navy, life, and work. So he put the oars down for about 40 years. And so one night in his 60s.
I was asleep dreaming that I was rowing in the basin in the dark with other boats, which I could see by their lights. And when I woke up, enough of that dream stuck with me, and I said to myself, I should start rowing again.
So Carlo got back in a racing shell in 1998 and hasn't looked back since. For Margarita, rowing was a way to see the world when her native Latvia was part of the USSR.
There was this iron curtain. You couldn't travel. But when you were a good rower, and I discovered first you travel for rowing camps all around Soviet Union, but then, oh, if you are good, you actually can go across the border and you can compete in Western countries.
Now, she and Carlo travel the globe to row together, and it's probably easier for them to name the countries in Europe they haven't been to than the ones they have.
Most of the countries in Western Europe, not Portugal, not Serbia, not Estonia, but just about everywhere else.
The Zezas aren't the type to go around bragging, but they don't have to inside the Cambridge Boat Club. Their photos hang on the wall for course records each of them have set. Brendan Mulvey is race director for the head of the Charles. He says there's about 25 athletes aged 80 and older in this year's race. Mulvey says Carlo's been winning for a long time.
If you look at our historical list of winners, Carlo's name is on there pretty much throughout.
Carlo has reached the age where many of his friends have stopped rowing, mostly because of health. But he's not looking to stop anytime soon, at least not when he has Margarita as a partner.
As long as the luck holds out and it continues being fun, I have her to pull me in the double as long as possible.
On land, they're a couple. But on the water, they row as one.
That's Esteban Bustillos reporting. And that wraps up this week's News Roundup. I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.